Kamai, Hairi Mai. Cassandra Kailaho, and this is Safe and Sound, New Zealand's animal rights show, broadcasting from Free FM in Hamilton and played right throughout the country via the Access radio sector. We're proudly sponsored by Village Organics in Frankton, and so if you're in the Waikato and you haven't already checked them out, go on down to the end of Commerce Street opposite the Frankton Hotel and see for yourself the compassionate choices they have to offer. Speaking for myself, I'm delighted that we now have a Labour New Zealand First Greens coalition. And quite apart from the belief that this will result in a fairer country for all New Zealanders, it spells out good news for animals. All three parties are in favour of having an independent commissioner for animals, for example, and the Greens in particular, influenced no doubt by the wonderful Mojo Mothers, have long had a compassionate and rational approach to animal welfare and rights. I think we're going to see broad-ranging changes come about, including stock numbers, and I cannot wait to see all factory farming banned in New Zealand. It has to happen, and now it can be sooner rather than later. Today I'll be catching up with Lindley Tulloch, who, unfortunately for Safe and Sound, has moved out of Hamilton and won't be on the show with me regularly anymore. But don't let that stop you from listening to Safe and Sound, because she will be checking in from time to time. I recorded a chat with her earlier, and we discussed the 2050 predator-free New Zealand and compassionate conservation. But before that, I speak with young Auckland activist Daniel Rutherford-Smith, who organises the Cube of Truth demonstrations in Auckland. Cube of Truth is highly effective public outreach that uses masks and flat screen devices to show what animals raised for food experience every second of every day. I began by asking Daniel what led him to his animal rights vegan journey.
So I was quite sick, chronically fatigued and depressed and all that, tired all the time. So I was looking online for, I guess, a way to cure it, and this sort of led me into a spiral of looking through all these just different videos, just random topics and stuff, and I guess I eventually came across something, and then that just led me on another spiral of watching all this vegan content, and yeah, I went vegan, and...
Because of what you saw on the animal videos, is that right?
Yeah, there's a range of videos, so I was watching people talk about the health benefits of it and the troubles with the environment.
Right.
It's animal agriculture as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, especially the animals. I watched a few well-known speeches.
I don't honestly think I have ever seen a video of animal cruelty. I've never been able to. I mean, I've wanted to. I've started to watch Earthlings, and I couldn't get through more than just a few seconds of it. I read about what happens, but it's seeing it that is mightily upsetting to me. Anyhow, that's why I'm interested in the Cube of Truth. So you're responsible for the Cube of Truth demonstrations in Auckland. Is that right, Daniel?
Yep. So I'm now the sole organiser.
Right. I believe that the organisation who actually started the Cube of Truth is Anonymous for the Voiceless. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so it was started in Melbourne, and they were experimenting with the same ideas that had been used in London, which was a very similar idea, except it was less structured and they used different masks and there just weren't as many rules to it.
Right. What makes Cube of Truth so striking as an outreach for the animals, and how is it different? What makes it unique?
I think how striking and professional it looks, how well organized it looks. It's not just like a random collaboration of people holding signs or anything like that. And I think people really are drawn to that. It looks so strong.
Yes, it sort of carries with it the heightened reality of a theatre production, for example.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of theatre elements to it. So you get the people who are doing it, maybe it's 8 or 10 people, and they stand in a little square like a cube. Is that right?
Yep. We'll have maybe 50% of people holding devices usually, and then the rest are holding signs.
Right, and that sign says one word, doesn't it? And that's truth.
Yeah, that's the most common sign.
Yeah, and so the people standing pretty much back to back in a cube shape, and they're holding, or some of them, there's some people sort of walking around and presumably engaging with passers-by, but the people doing the demonstration, they've got a laptop, is that right? And what's showing on the laptop?
Yeah, so either laptop or TVs, if you get the battery sorted and you can run TVs off a cable battery.
Yeah.
That's what some people do. What we're showing is internationally most organizations will be showing local as much as possible.
Right.
Local footage, but there are some international ones that are used, and these represent standard practices for most countries.
In factory farming, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it is, and that's because that factory farming is the standard practice for most things. We just prefer to use the New Zealand footage.
Right.
The farm watch that shows what happens to the pigs.
Oh dear. And can you say the kind of thing that is shown on the farm watch video?
Generally just the condition.
Yeah. I mean, that's enough, isn't it? And those tiny little enclosures never see the light of day. Mothers virtually separated from their piglets with iron bars. It's a nightmare. So you show some farm watch video, and you're also, this is an important element, isn't it? You're also wearing masks.
Yeah.
What's the point of wearing masks?
The masks are mostly just to disconnect the people holding the device from the public so that the public don't engage directly with the people who are showing them the message.
Right, understand, and, yeah.
Gives them time to process what they're seeing, and then we can have someone, after a while, go up and approach them and maybe have a conversation with them, ask them some questions about what they've just seen.
Right, so it's a pretty striking thing. You have these people standing in white masks, Guy Fawkes masks, and holding some really terrible footage on their laptops. And so a lot of people would probably stop, at least for a short while. Those who linger and really watch it, what percentage are they?
That is hard to say. Depends on the day as well.
Right.
But if we've got a good flow happening with the public, then it tends to be quite high. As to how many people stop for just enough to watch it is probably about 30%.
30%.
But then maybe people who stay to talk is maybe more 5 to 10% at most.
Right.
But there's just so many people in our spot, so it's constant foot traffic. So.
Yeah, and presumably children with their parents. Do you see any children watching it?
We don't get too many children stopping and watching it. It's mostly teenagers, the younger crowd that stop and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a policy to try and spot any children watching unattended so that we can, at the very least, talk them through what they're seeing or find their parent or whatever.
Right. And so once someone has stayed for a little while and they've watched the video or most of it, some others in your group may approach them and ask if they've got any questions. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then a conversation starts about cruelty to animals and factory farming in particular, but also the benefits of veganism and how animal agriculture contributes to so much in terms of global warming, deforestation, even starving people, right?
Yeah. We mostly try to engage people, get their empathy and their compassion.
Yeah.
And try and just show them that this is what they want, because it is. They don't want to hurt animals for no reason.
Yes, yeah.
And sometimes they won't take like the ethical side seriously. That doesn't matter to them. So we might try and talk to them about the environment or maybe even their health.
Mm. So I imagine it's a deep, visceral kind of reaction that people have once they have watched the footage all the way through, and then, as you say, presumably what they're feeling is pity for the animals or revulsion that it can happen. And so you concentrate on the animal side of things. And when you're briefed, are you told the kind of things that you could say with people? Or I just have the idea that this is a very well-organized, well-structured movement and that people are doing and saying pretty much the same things?
Yeah, most of the people we have that do outreach, talking to the public, are regulars, so I don't really have to explain it all the time.
No, yeah.
But if we do have people who don't really know what to say, I usually just tell them, ask them simple questions, and I give them examples of those questions.
Right.
Kind of open with.
Is the footage silent, or does it have a soundtrack?
We don't play sounds of what's happening in the videos, but we do have a playlist running.
Right.
Some quite feeling, somber.
Right, music. Yeah. So it is. It's like theatre, isn't it? It's street theatre, street activism. Yeah. Do you refer them to any websites or anything?
Yeah, we've got some little cards that we hand out to people if they want any information. And we usually have a table set up where we have some more resources sitting there.
Right. So I imagine that this has given you a real sense of purpose in your life.
Yeah, I don't like doing it, but it's something I do need to do. I feel I need to.
I understand that. In my slaughterhouse vigils that I do, I don't enjoy it one bit, but I continue to do it because I know it's effective. Now, since you started the vegan diet, you said that you were having some health issues. Has the vegan diet helped a lot with that?
Just cutting out all the animals in my diet, that made an immediate impact. Definitely felt lighter and happier.
And you've got more energy. You mentioned a little bit of depression. Has that improved since you've become vegan?
Yeah, I think it was probably a catalyst to helping me work through my issues just by sort of taking away the burden that my food had on me. It allowed me to have a better mindset and just focus on having more positive thoughts.
Yeah, and this is the point of actually doing something, isn't it? That it's, when you stop and think about it, it's pretty depressing. But when you know you're actually doing something and you're trying to make a difference, it does help that feeling of despair, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, look, I think that you're doing just a wonderful job organising Cube of Truth in Auckland, and I suppose anyone can start the Cube of Truth anywhere in New Zealand or elsewhere in the world. So what's the first step if someone wants to start?
Yeah, they can just get in contact with Anonymous for the Voiceless by email, going through their website, anonymousforthevoiceless.org.
Yeah.
They'll tell you all you need to know.
All they need to know.
Christchurch, they're doing really well. We've got Wellington starting up soon.
That's brilliant. So we need one in Hamilton.
yeah, there's actually been talk about that too.
Yeah. Oh, wouldn't it be great if every small town in New Zealand had this really effective, dramatic, powerful kind of action on behalf of the animals and leaving those lasting images in people's mind that, as I said, gives them a really emotional reaction. And
I guess it's like making up for all the advertising, normalizing the animals' bodies.
Yes.
Like we're just kind of
what is behind the hamburger, the KFC? You know, this is the reality. Make the connection. Hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, Daniel, it's been wonderful talking to you. And
you too.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah, you too. I will have to join one of your vigils one time.
So you come down from Auckland. There are others who come all the way down from Auckland.
Yeah.
Great people to put themselves out to that extent, that they come and do vigils in the Waikato when they're based in Auckland. I really love that. I hope to meet you, Daniel. And maybe one day I'll put a mask on and stand with you in the Cube of Truth.
That would be awesome.
Okay, dear. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So, Lindley, I asked you not to leave Hamilton, but you went ahead and did it anyhow.
I did it anyhow. One of the very few times I've disobeyed you.
So, what are you doing now?
I've taken up a position as a tutor in early childhood education at Tertiary Pregnant Training Institution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm involved in early childhood education. and just making a new life for myself up here near Auckland. I am really missing the show, though. I really am, and hope to get down a bit more often.
Yeah, it would be great to see you down here, but I know that you're always very busy, and, you know, in every waking hour, you're continuing to work for the animals. Oh, by the way, you're a doctor. You're officially Dr. Lindley to call it now, aren't you?
I am,
that's
thank
right,
you.
Yes.
Yes, I got my PhD earlier on this year, so I'm really excited about that.
Yes, and so now all these opinion editorials that you're writing, they have Dr. Lindley Tulloch on them.
Yeah.
It's a good job you're not here anymore. I'd be too intimidated, I think.
Oh, well, I don't think so.
I read all your opinion editorials, of course, and I was really interested in the latest one, which is about the so-called predator-free New Zealand by 2050. Now, you're very much a minority voice, an articulate one, but a minority voice. Tell us what your take is on predator-free New Zealand and the way we're going about it.
Well, I don't know how much people know about this predator-free 2050 policy, so I can just very briefly address that.
Mm-hmm.
Predator-free 2050 is the idea that by 2050 there's going to be no introduced species in New Zealand. Of course, the language that the Department of Conservation often uses around that is unwanted vermin, or something along those lines. Mm. And so the Department of Conservation is heavily involved in trying to eradicate all introduced species in New Zealand by that date. So the policy was launched by the last national government. One of the main issues I heard with the predator-free 2050 goal is that from the outset it was suggested that community groups were involved in the killing of animals. They wanted not just to be a department initiative, but rather to involve people, families, communities and neighbourhoods, and to some extent schools as well. So they encourage community-led projects to kill possums, rats and stoats in particular, and the Department of Conservation thinks that it's really important that New Zealanders get on board with this dogma and this desire to kill introduced species, so much so that the actual killing itself is never questioned, and that these animals are demonised to a very large extent as pests, and because of that, the language that is used is one of hatred. So my problem with that is that I think it's promoting a very superficial attitude towards animals, and one that objectifies them and treats them in very harsh ways and justifies the very inhumane and harsh treatment of them. I have been actively campaigning against school possum hunts, which aren't necessarily sanctioned by the Department of Conservation, but I think that they have arisen as a result of the general climate that has been generated through Department of Conservation propaganda around these issues. And school possum hunts, I think you may be aware of my involvement in photographing the baby joeys that
drowned.
Were drowned at the Drury School possum hunt. And subsequent to that, there was international media attention around the fact that two girls were involved in dropping these joeys into buckets of water.
Mm.
It's actually an inhumane way to kill newborn animals, because newborn animals have a diving reflex. If they're dropped into water, they'll instantly close off their airway passage. Newborns will die dry drown, which is a really horrific and horrible way to drown.
Mm.
It's something that's actually illegal. So I drew it to the attention of the MPI and the SPCA, and Drury School has been working, I understand, with the SPCA as a result of that. They didn't realise at the time that it was inhumane, and now they do, and so they're working on other ways of dealing with the situation.
You bring up a good point. Is there really such a thing as humane killing?
Well, I think it's an oxymoron to put those two things together, I have an issue with the latest statement by Nicola Toki, who's the Department of Conservation Ambassador for Endangered Species, and she's put out a piece recently about killing animals with kindness. That notion of killing, when you take the life of an animal who is healthy in the prime of their life and wants to live, and you take that life from them, you cannot then call that a kind act or a humane act in any way.
No.
What we're actually doing is humane washing what is essentially a very unkind act.
Yes.
And I think that we need to take off the blinkers that we have towards this notion of humaneness and see the act for what it really is. We want something from the animals, whether we want them gone because they're pests, or we want to eat them, or because we want to wear their skin, or we want to put it on sofas, we want the egg. Any number of reasons we want something from that animal justifies the means of of killing them and taking away the one and only life that they ever have.
And it makes it much easier when we call them vermin and when we generate hatred for them by using emotive terms. Everyone knows that the only good possum is a dead possum, right? I've heard my 6, 7, 8-year-old students saying that, you know, repeating what their parents have said. At the same time, a problem exists. I know that you are into compassionate conservation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Compassionate conservation is a really interesting approach to conservation of wild animals, and it's one that has a no-kill premise to it. And so the idea of compassionate conservation is to consider every animal as an individual, and so it aligns very well with vegan beliefs around every animal having a right to their life. And it's gaining ground in academia and within people involved in conservation recently. The groundbreaking symposium in Oxford was in 2010, where a group of key individuals developed the guiding principles for it. I can just read you those principles. Yep. I'll outline them for you. I won't read them. 5 of them: recognizing that wild animals, whether free-ranging or in captivity, may be affected by the intentional or unintentional actions of humans, as well as the natural processes within ecosystems and their wider environment. And we're concerned that these human activities, including those undertaken for conservation purposes, may cause harm to individual wild animals, populations, species, or ecosystems. Then there's a recognition that both conservation and wild animal welfare should implicitly respect the inherent value of wild animals. So that's where it aligns with those vegan beliefs of all animals having an inherent value, and that we attempt not to cause harm knowingly to them, and that both disciplines should try to mitigate harm caused by humans to other species. The 4th one is believing that all harm to wild animals should be minimised wherever and to the extent possible, regardless of the human intention and purpose behind them. And finally, proposing that the principles and actions that underpin compassionate conservation, by combining consideration of animal welfare and conservation, will lead to a reduction in harm and the suffering of wild animals and improve conservation outcomes. So it's a very different approach to the current approach taken in conservation, whereby animals are considered as members of a species, and that species is labelled and either demonised or protected accordingly. Yes. And this one actually sees animals as individuals within ecosystems, and the inherent worth of the individuals within those ecosystems is valued. Now, we hope that through that approach, ecosystems will be improved, not harmed. Mm. I think we've got a case in point, really, with what we're doing in New Zealand with the dropping of 1080, where there is quite a lot of damage done to ecosystems through the dropping of 1080, yet the premise is that it's improving ecosystem viability. And some people would argue that 1080 is doing more harm to native species than any potential good it could possibly do.
There's a lot of bi-kill as well, of non-targeted animals, isn't there?
Absolutely. In terms of the cruelty aspect of it, 1080 is an incredibly harmful poison.
Yes.
And that's something that's very much overlooked by people who are promoting it.
But we have to admit that there is a problem. So what, for example, do we do with possums and with rats and stoats? How do we begin to control their numbers?
Well, that's something that I've given quite a lot of thought to just recently, actually. Some of the approaches that we can use include immunocontraception, whereby a male possum is put out with the general population and he actually makes all the other possums infertile, unable to reproduce, where he impregnates a female. Those babies then can't reproduce from there on in, if that makes sense. And then they pass on that inability to reproduce to others.
So, in other words, every issue from the affected male possum will be infertile?
That's right. Well, you stop them reproducing through repeated generations. It's a birth control method that uses the body's immune system to prevent pregnancy, and you can use it with possums. Landcare research is doing it. So the vaccine will only act against sperm or eggs and should occur only in possums, so it doesn't go out to other species. It's called biological control. It hopes to reduce the frequency and the cost of possum control. Obviously, we can replace, hopefully, more conventional methods, eliminating poison, and also the risks, as you were talking about before, to non target species. The problem is when non-target species get the 1080 poison in their system is that they suffer from hours of horrendous and prolonged deaths, and as do the possums. And the other issue that often people don't think about is that baby joeys are left to starve in the pouches of their mother, or they die from cold and exposure. And so all the way down the line, 1080's got a number of issues associated with it. Trapping, I've seen, been out on walks and seen these possums in these yellow traps, and I know they look yellow, and one possum I saw, he really looked as if his feet were positioned as if he was pushing away from the trap, so he looked like there was a moment he was in pain and knew what was happening to him. I don't think trapping or shooting necessarily is a painless process for possums to go through either, or 1080.
Yeah. Look, we've just about run out of time, Lindy. Anything else that you want to say until next time we hear you on Safe and Sound?
We're trying to get a ban on all school possum hunts. So there is a petition that has been circulated that is going to be presented to Parliament. Right. So look out for news on that.
You've been collaborating with Dr. Mark Beckhoff, the well-known biologist.
You had him on the Safe and Sound show.
Yeah, that's right. But you've written
with
them.
Can people still access that?
Yes, people can still access it. We've got a number of sites now.
Mark Beckhoff is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado.
Right.
And he's written some absolutely amazing books. He's a bit of a hero to me, I must say. An amazing guy with a very intelligent response to conservation ethos and ethics.
So, wanton killing of possums and rats and stoats too, just because we can, is not the vegan way, is it? It's not the way that looks forward to a more compassionate, more peaceful society where species can coexist.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Very good.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and I look forward to being on the show more.
All right. Take care.
Okay,
Talk soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.
I didn't ask Lindley if the immunosterilization method compromised the quality of life of the animal at all, apart from their infertility. If it affects their immune system, well, anyway, I'll be reading up about that, and we'll also put some links up on our Facebook page, Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast. So head over to our page, and if you haven't already done so, please like us. Our thanks to both Lindley and Daniel. The old saying comes to mind, there are two important dates in an individual's life, the day they are born and the day they discover why they are born, the day they discover their purpose in life. Lindley has a strong sense of purpose, as I do, and it sounds to me like Daniel also feels a call and is doing his best to answer it. We all share the same goal, to make the world a better place for animals, and of course, for people too. The two are interlinked. I'm feeling optimistic that world is just around the corner, or just over the rainbow. And, well, Israel Kamakawole, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. Anyhow, that guy says it much better. Until next time, folks, go well. Matiwa. Bye-bye. Birds fly.